Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone.
So here we are recording in December, and it's almost Christmas.
Almost, yep, it's coming right around.
And we have kind of a special Christmas event this year, don't we, Mom?
Yes, we do.
we have a wedding in the family just a few days after Christmas.
Yeah, and the family will be here. All of your siblings will be here. That's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, all five of us in one place at one time.
Yeah, right.
Alert the media. Right.
Doesn't happen so often.
No, it doesn't. Okay. It's true. That's true. So what do we have in store for our listeners today?
Well, today we have a very unusual book and an interesting one. It's How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship. And the author is Eva Hagberg Fisher, and she is she has a degree in architecture. I think that's so interesting. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, T, the New York Times Style Magazine, Tin House, Wallpaper, Wired, and Dwell, and she lives now in California and New York City.
So welcome to Writer's Voices, Eva.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So did you always want to be a writer?
Yes.
Isn't architecture kind of a... a detour from that path?
So I wanted to be a writer since I was 3 or 4. I started reading when I was 3 and didn't have a ton of friends growing up. And my parents are all academics. So I knew that sitting at your computer, sitting at your typewriter and typing and producing words that somebody else would want to read was some kind of job. And I thought that that was the kind of job that I would want to have. And I spent so much time reading such incredibly good literature as a child that I had a lot of anxiety about being a good enough writer and a lot of fear. And so when I went to college, a lot of my friends took creative writing classes. They got really into writing. And I was just afraid. I didn't think that I was talented enough. And I knew that the other subject that I really loved was architecture. So I started majoring in architecture, discovered that I cannot draw to save my life. I cannot conceptualize space. I cannot decide which color is better than another color. But what I could do was describe architecture, and I could see buildings in a way, and I could talk about them and write about them in a way that people really responded to. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'm going to write about architecture. And you know, I'm primarily an architectural thinker, but I'm using writing as a medium to discuss these ideas. And then very, very slowly became more confident in my architectural writing and started branching out and writing an essay here and there, writing a short story. And I wanted to write a book for my whole life. And I think I just didn't really have a topic until all of these events happened in my life, until, you know, I met somebody that I wanted to introduce other people to, but somebody who doesn't live on this planet anymore, you know, so the way that I introduced her had to be through writing about her. So you're right. I mean, it does seem sort of incongruous. And I think now in my career, I interviewed an architect this morning and realized that I have two simultaneous careers at the same time. And one is writing, you know, this memoir, and then one is really talking to architects and articulating their ideas.
Wow. So How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship. I mean, it is your memoir, but it is also very much about this friend.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you bond so much with her, with Allison?
You know, I think that was 75 to 96% Allison, and then this is why I'm not an architect. Whatever percentage is left over is me. She is somebody, you know, I was on Facebook the other day and I saw that somebody posted on her wall. She still has one of these legacy walls and they talked about something that Allison had taught her, which was before she went to sleep, if she was feeling anxious, to recall the faces and names of people that she loved and pray for them to be having a good day, to be feeling good, to be having a good life. And it reminded me of two things. One was of how special my relationship with Allison was, and then two, how absolutely not special my relationship with her was, because she just had this ability to connect with people on a level that was so intimate and vulnerable. And, you know, as I say in the beginning of the book, like, I was really confused by her vibe. I didn't understand how she would tell people the truth about herself and people would be more drawn to her. And I didn't want to tell anybody the truth about myself, but I wanted to brag and, you know, list my degrees and tell them how cool I was. And people, you know, given the choice between being friends with me or being friends with Allison, all went to Allison. So I was like, what's going on here? This doesn't make sense. Like, I'm the person who's, you know, pursuing a PhD at UC Berkeley. Why don't you want to be my friend? And it's because I wasn't being vulnerable with anybody and I wasn't being intimate. And Allison just, she taught me, and I think she taught a lot of us, that, you know, you can be so lovable when you're suffering and when you're telling the truth about that. And she had this effect on pretty much everyone. I mean, there's this sort of fan club and I'm just the one who took the notes, you know, and is publishing them.
Now, when you met her, she had been fighting cancer for quite a few years, correct?
She had, and I think that she would have some comments about the use of the word fighting. Mm-hmm. She had cancer. Yeah, she had had breast cancer 10 years before I met her, and then 6 years before I met her, it had metastasized to her liver. So when we met, all I knew was that she had, you know, metastasized breast cancer, which I had really no understanding of. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what metastasis meant. I didn't understand how you could have breast cancer that was not in your breast. But she had been given, I think, 6 months to live when I met her.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And how long did she live after you met her?
She lived for 4 or 5 more years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 4 more years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So...
So what would be her problem with the word fighting?
So she, I don't want to speak for her, but I want to speak for myself, given what I've learned from her, which is that, you know, there's a sort of very American narrative about illness, which is that it's a thing that happens and we battle it or we fight it or we're on the battleground or on the battlefield. And, you know, Susan Sontag wrote so well about this and illness as metaphor. And my observation of Allison's illness was that she was suffering a lot. And the day-to-day experience was one of just having to submit to treatment after treatment after treatment and experiencing hope and wanting to stay alive. But I think that when we talk about fighting illness, it sort of makes some of us think that if you're really strong in some inherent way, or you're really smart, or you're really, you know, supported, then you're going to beat this. And Allison didn't, you know, win. I mean, she didn't beat cancer. And when I think about her, I mean, this is bringing, you know, tears to my eyes right now, because it's not that she did a bad job. It's not that she didn't fight hard enough. It's just that she had cancer, and cancer is lethal. And so, you know, and I remember her saying that she was pretty sure she was dying, and a lot of people were really uncomfortable with that and wanted to say, you know, don't stop fighting, don't give up. And at a certain point, she just wanted people to say, God, I'm so sorry. You know, I'm so sorry that you're dying. And I think we, you know, as a culture generally don't want to go there with people. You know, we want to use metaphors of strength and fighting and power. And I remember just seeing her do everything right You know, she did everything right. And she still died. And,
you know, I've thought about this as I have watched some people, I've had some friends who died from cancer, and everybody has a cure, an anecdotal cure, a diet or a healer or a crystal or something that's going to cure you. And how hard it must be when you're in that situation to figure out, well, which of these things do I try and which do I not? Or do I just say the heck with it and I'm going to live as long as I can just the way that I was and not have my entire focus be on trying to beat this disease?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember when she, so it metastasized from her liver into her bones and then it metastasized into her brain. And that was really the death sentence. And a mutual friend came over and Allison was telling her, you know, the result of her latest scan and what was going on. And the friend said, you know, I heard this great story. My hairdresser's friend's cousin's son, he had this, you know, wacky thing and everybody thought he was going to die, but he lived. And I remember I didn't say anything because I didn't know how to articulate my response at that time. But I was like, this isn't
helpful.
I don't think this is what Allison wants to hear. Right. And I talk about this a little bit in the book where, you know, I think that sometimes when we don't know what to do, we want to give advice and we want to reflexively help and jump in and have a solution. And I think also sometimes, you know, I know for me, before I got really comfortable with illness and before I became more comfortable with dying, I mean, I had a lot of these same responses and I wanted to offer denial as a solution. You know, I wanted to offer denial and sort of false hope. And just seeing how painful that was for Allison, or seeing people say, you know, oh, well, did you smoke? And the code is, I didn't smoke, so do you think I'm okay? You know, I remember when I was going through a lot of biopsies and scans, and I ate a lot of candy because that's how I coped. And somebody said to me, you know, candy, sugar feeds cancer. So if you think you have cancer, you definitely shouldn't eat sugar. And I was furious with her, you know, because I was like, give me my one comfort.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Maybe sugar does cause cancer, but I needed to eat my Sour Patch Kids Extreme. You know, it was all I had.
I don't know how much sugar there is in Sour Patch Kids.
I don't know. I've done this myself. Sometimes people don't know what to say, so they say something dumb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here's I just want to say the difference between me and Allison is that when somebody said something dumb to me, I would snap and I would be cold and I would tell them why they were wrong. And Allison would say, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your care. And so she just had this grace that I, you know, have tried to get, but I'm just not wired that way.
Well, we're all a little bit different. That's what makes life interesting, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I was amazed at the detail that you have in your book, and I was thinking, how does she remember all that? My gosh, I can't remember what I had for lunch, maybe, you know? I mean, gosh, that was amazing. Did you keep a journal, or?
Yeah, I didn't. It's funny, I also don't know what I had for lunch, and I had lunch an hour ago, but I remember things. I have a very visual memory, and so I was also very confused about how I was going to remember everything. But I found that as soon as I started writing, I would see her bedroom and I would see her and I would hear her voice. And I would think to myself, what detail does the reader need to be able to, you know, see her bedroom or hear the cadence in the way that she talks? You know, she always said that everybody started a sentence with, well, the thing is, and nobody besides Allison started a sentence like that. And so I wanted to really use detail to really anchor these often sort of ephemeral and very abstract conceptual observations that I'm making in something that's really specific. But no, I mean, I didn't fact check. I didn't have a journal. I just trusted my memory of everything and trusted that sort of video camera that I have that I can turn on. And that's from being a reporter for 15 years. And I was a reporter for 15 years before I started writing this book. And so I had just trained myself to be able to recall a scene with pretty vivid accuracy and clarity.
Yeah, well, that experience helped, I'm sure, mm-hmm. because then you were able to do that. It's amazing to me that you were. It really is.
Thank you.
So, Eva, what were you studying at Berkeley for your PhD?
So I got my master's in architectural history, and then I left the architecture department and I formed an interdisciplinary field called visual and narrative culture. And it's a blend of American studies, history of art, architecture, and history. So I was working on Aline Luhaim Saarinen, who was the wife of the Finnish-American architect Eero Saarinen. And I was looking at their correspondence and making an argument about their sort of her professional contribution to his life. So I was reading a lot of love letters when I was writing this book, actually, which I think influenced me.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah,
what drew you? I mean, that seems like a very specific topic.
I know. So I got my PhD maybe 3 weeks ago, and I was walking around and thinking to myself that I'm literally the living world expert on this incredibly minute, incredibly precisely defined field. I mean, I sort of worked backwards, you know, so I was in this program. I was going to write a dissertation about science fiction movies and architecture, and I don't really know what I was, you know, I was a typical grad student in that I had 14 different ideas and was equally committed to all of them. And I just stumbled across this archive, which is digitized by the Smithsonian, and I was completely entranced by the way in which Eero Saarinen and Aline Luhaim wrote to each other. And I was in a relationship with Cameron, who I describe in the book. And that was a very tumultuous, stressful, difficult relationship. And I just gotten out of that and met my now husband. And I was wildly in love with him. And I was in love with being in love. And I was obsessed with how in love with each other we were. And so I found these letters and I knew that I wanted to work with them in some way. And so I constructed an argument, which I hoped would be supported by the evidence, which thankfully was supported by the evidence. So I really started with the archive set that I wanted to look at and the ideas that I wanted to think about, which were how we use correspondence and diary and how we use writing about ourselves to actually begin to build ourselves into existence. And so a lot of their relationship is mediated through these letters in which they say, you know, I am this person to you, or I want to be this person to you. And that was just a fascinating theoretical place for me to live for some time. And it was weird because I don't know how many people write a book and a dissertation at the same time, but even though there's no overlapping content or overlapping stories, I really thinking about the way in which I was writing about somebody that I loved was very informed by reading about somebody else writing about how she loved somebody. So
you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Eva Habsburg-Fisher, author of How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship, which is coming out on February 5th. It's being published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt on February 5th. So let's talk a little bit about the writing process that you had, because you were working on these two things at the same time. Did you have certain times of day where you'd work on one or the other, or how did you multitask?
So I had this fantasy when I sold the book that I would go on a 3-month writing retreat and I would go to the woods and I would get really deep with myself and have a lot, you know, I'm in a lot of social media groups for writers and they talk about, you know, bleeding on the page and the sweat and the tears that go into it. And I was really excited about doing that, but I am just a pragmatic worker. I was given a deadline and I was a little bit scared of my editor. And so I just didn't want to miss the deadline. And I also found that I needed a certain amount of very measured distance from this book in order to write it. And so I treated it like a job. I treated it like any other writing job that I have. This is my process. I sign some sort of contract. I'm very excited about it. And then weeks and weeks and weeks go by, and I think in the back of my mind about whatever I'm supposed to be writing. And this was, of course, the biggest assignment that I'd ever had. And then I panic, and then I become convinced that like my entire career is based on, you know, a lot of lucky breaks, and I have no idea how I'm going to do this. And I look at the blank page and I think I have no idea where to start. And then I finally just get myself so worked up. You know, I eat a lot of chocolate. I pass out. I wake up. I like pound a lot of coffee. I mean, I just basically get myself very loosened up. And then I start writing, and then it just tells me what it wants to be. So there was a moment where the book went from something that I felt that I was really directing into something that had its own internal logic. And it was really an iterative process. I mean, I've rewritten this book. I think I had 47 separate drafts on my computer. Yeah. And so much of it was just going over the skeleton and rewriting and cutting and rewriting and cutting and rewriting and cutting at, you know, almost ad infinitum. You know, and a lot of it was this process of sort of solving a puzzle where I would say, you know, something would happen on page 132. That's a random
right,
page. Don't
right.
be looking for something amazing on page 132. Although I hope every page has something amazing, right? But I would need that to have a payoff. And so in order for that to have a payoff, I would have to work backwards and think, well, what do I need to establish in the beginning in order for the reader to feel like, oh, this is really, you know, there is an arc here. There is a catharsis. And I was able to be, I think just because of my personality, pretty dispassionate about the actual events that I was writing about. So, you know, for instance, I needed to show that I was transformed by my relationship with Allison, right? So I couldn't start out being a super great person who feels great and then end up being a super great person who feels great. And so I really had to lean in the first third of the book into the things that I'm mostly ashamed of and that I'm embarrassed of and that I don't want people to know, and, you know, infidelities that I've committed and ways that I felt about them and the sort of perspective that I have now. And I just kept thinking, you know, I'm just going to do what the book wants. I mean, the book wants me to do this. I'm just going to do it. And I'll worry about it later. You know, I'll worry about offending people later. I'll worry about offending myself later. And I, you know, I'm still worried about it. I mean, I still haven't cut anything out that, you know, for being worried about other people. I've cut things because it doesn't work. But I was also involved in a really protracted, really difficult sexual harassment case at UC Berkeley while I was writing this book. And I think that this book became a refuge from that because I had to be so careful. And I was talking to a lot of lawyers and, you know, I was really trying not to get sued. And I had a lot of fear and control over everything that I said. And so I had to constantly sort of represent being, you know, a perfect survivor of sexual harassment, a perfect advocate. I mean, I put that pressure on myself. Nobody asked me to do that, but that was the pressure that I felt. And so this book was this project that only I was reading, only my editor and I were reading it. I didn't send it out to anybody else. And it just was this like sort of secret, precious thing that I got to do. So it didn't feel like a distraction. It felt like such a privilege and a joy. And I loved writing it. I loved every single minute of writing it. And when I really finished it, I cried because I missed it. You know, I went with my friend Lauren, who's in the last act, to Sedona, and I was being really, really rude to the Safeway Starbucks person, and Lauren was like, "This is, you know, not like you. What's going on?" And I was like, "I miss my book. I want to work on it again," because I started reading it to myself every night to really feel the structure and feel the cadence and notice where I would start to think, "Oh, I've read this section. I know how it goes." I was like, "No, I need to fix that section." So It really became part of me. And then the dissertation was something that I just really avoided. And, you know, I basically did it in a panic in the last 3 months. And that's what I've heard happens, right? You spend almost a decade in grad school and all of that is preparing for the final push. And so rewrote it in the last 3 months. Yeah.
Wow.
So can't wait to do it again.
Wait, you spent almost a decade pursuing?
Which is why I was like, I was very relaxedly pursuing the PhD. I wasn't really pursuing it so much as, you know, ambivalently coexisting.
But how does that work? Do you have to pay tuition every year?
Oh, I have $200,000 in student loans.
Oh, mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And it was weird because, you know, coming from journalism, I was used to being paid for my writing, and I realized I just paid $200,000 so that I could write 250 pages about a topic that hopefully more than five people are interested in, but very possibly not. So it was sort of a weird thing. You know, I was like cashing one check for my writing to then send a check on to UC Berkeley to pay for the privilege of writing under their guidance. But I learned a lot. So no regrets, truly. And I also took a lot of creative writing workshops while I was at Berkeley and, you know, took the equivalent of 2.5 years of an MFA program with amazing writers, with Tom Farber, Bharati Mukherjee, Vikram Chandra. And I never workshopped this book with them, but I wrote a lot of short stories. I wrote a lot of creative nonfiction. And they really taught me so much about pacing and dialogue and scenes and language and all of that. So I sort of like snuck myself the equivalent of an MFA experience, which I think was worth it.
It sounds like you've had a lot of change in your life in the last 10 years.
Yes.
And a lot of stress.
Mm.
From, you know, moving cross country to start this program at Berkeley, and then getting ill yourself. We haven't really talked too much about that yet. Mm-hmm. And working, you know, writing a book and writing a thesis and getting your doctorate and getting married.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What's are you going yeah. to like gonna just take it easy for a while now?
You know, I have this fantasy, recurring fantasy that I'm going to go live on the beach in Tulum for a year and raise a goat and teach goat yoga. And I talk to my husband about this every couple months, every 6 months. I'm like, oh, I just, you know, I wish everything would fall apart so I could, you know, move to Tulum. And he says, Eva, we would have to get the Coast Guard to get you out after a week and a half. I mean, I'm just not wired for relaxation. What I am wired for is restoration. And that's the thing that I've really been thinking about the last year, is the difference between how I try to relax, which is actually not relaxing, which is I go on Twitter and I get into fights with people, or I watch 17 episodes of a TV show while also posting on Instagram, while also eating Nerds Ropes, while also eating ice cream. And then I'm like, why am I not relaxed? So what I've been looking for are experiences that feel restorative. And for me, that's, you know, going to look at a body of water, going to a yoga class, meditating for 5 minutes, telling the truth about myself to a friend, telling the truth about myself to a group of people. So I don't think that I'm wired for rest, which has been, you know, problematic in my life and has potentially led to my suffering physically more than maybe I, you know, quote unquote needed to. But I also, like, I don't have the ability to see what I do very clearly. And I'll often ask people, you know, you've known me for a couple years. Do you think that more things happen to me than happen to other people? Or do you think I'm just more dramatic about it? And they'll invariably say, no, I think just more things happen to you. So I've just said to people, like, I just don't think that I got benched in this lifetime. You know, I don't think any of us get benched in this lifetime, but I really feel like I'm here. I'm supposed to be experiencing a lot. I'm supposed to be talking about it. So I'm just going to. And then I'm going to find moments where, you know, if I do a couple yoga poses for 20 minutes, that's going to restore me psychically. Mm. But honestly, my experience of my life is that I really don't feel like I do anything. I mean, I feel like I just sort of hang out and I like send some emails and, you know, eventually like things get written, but I mostly just watch TV and eat candy. And somehow I have this entire body of work and successful career, but I don't really know how it happens. And I'm actually afraid to look too closely at it. And I'm afraid to open the door to my quote unquote creativity, because I'm like, you know, it just exists. It's just over there and I'm not going to mess with it. And I'm not going to try and figure out how it works. I'm just going to let it happen because it's worked so far.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Eva Habsburg-Fisher, author of How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship. One thing you mentioned, that you had a contract for the book while you were writing it. That's pretty uncommon for someone who has not published a book before to get a contract before the book is complete. How did that happen for you?
Mm-hmm. So just before that, I wish that I were a Habsburg, European royalty, but I am Swedish Hagberg. Yes. I know. Am I actually a Habsburg? But very sadly, I am not. So I think you're right that it is unusual. And I'm also really glad that I sold it before I wrote it, because I'm so pragmatic and deadline oriented and assignment oriented that I would never have written this book if I hadn't had a deadline and, you know, guilt because I had cashed a check. I was introduced to my agent by a friend. The agent called me. I was at this time living in Sedona. I was sleeping in a tent every night. I had basically given up on a career. I was spending a lot of time lying down, scrolling BuzzFeed.com when it still had just an LOL vertical and trying to LOL. You know, I mean, I was, my husband was with me, but it was a very, very confusing, weird, dark time. And so this agent called me and I just thought, okay, I've always wanted to write a book. Maybe this is the time. And I'd written a couple scenes and I had the title in mind. I just knew that the title was going to be How to Be Loved. So sent the agent some of my work. She called me. She said, great, I'd love to represent you. Let's get this out before Christmas. And I think this was October or something. And then I wrote a proposal and I thought it was, you know, the most genius thing anybody had ever written. And I was sure we were going to sell it for $1 million. And my agent wrote back and said something like, I have no idea why you keep talking about rocks and your pelvis. This doesn't make any sense. Rewrite it. So I rewrote it and she said, okay, I don't understand why you're time traveling. And, you know, I had a lot of difficulty, you know, considering how or conceiving of this proposal. And I remember talking to her and saying like, well, you know, I mean, like memory isn't linear, you know, so like, and I just wanted to, like, you know, reinvent the wheel. And I kept thinking about doing, it was very influenced by writers like Lydia Yuknovich, who wrote this gorgeous, gorgeous memoir called The Chronology of Water. I was like, yeah, like, let's just get lyrical. But I actually can't do that. I'm too linear of a thinker. I'm too analytical of a thinker. So it wasn't working. So we did 5 proposals and she just didn't want to send any of them out. And then I was really hopeless. And we met up for coffee in San Francisco and she said, Eva, I think the book it's right there. You know, it's in the back of your head and you just have to bring it to the front. And then I read, I wish I could remember the title of this book. It's by this older woman who decided to have a vibrant sex life. And I started reading it and she described a scene. And I had been so concerned with making arguments and having a rich theoretical underpinning that I had forgotten that people want to read books in which things happen. And so I just thought about Allison and I thought, I just want the reader to meet this person. And I wrote what is essentially the first chapter now. I mean, the first chapter is almost untouched from what I ended up sending in. My agent read it. She just wrote back, yes, yes, yes. Sending this out next week. We sent it out next week. My editor and I ended up having a conversation on the phone. I got an email the next morning that she'd, you know, made a preempt offer and I had a book deal a day later.
Wow.
So it was 6 months of, you know, incredibly intensive struggle. And I remember thinking with this last proposal, you know, if my agent says no again, I got to give up. I can't do this again. And I got it. So,
but not by Christmas.
Not by Christmas. No, I sold it in May. So it took a while. And then my editor was like, great, give me 100 pages. And I went to Sedona. I wrote 100 pages of literally relationship drama. And I sent it to her. And she was like, great, great. We're just going to put these aside and maybe start at a different place. And those 100 pages have now been turned into 2 paragraphs. But I had to write those 100 pages to get to the point, you know. So my editor was extraordinarily instrumental in shaping the book. I mean, we knew what the scope was going to look like. We had the 3 acts in my proposal. They are still the same 3 acts. But she really pushed me to hit as many universal themes as I could. You know, neither of us wanted this to be an illness memoir. We really wanted it to be about friendship and about sort of different model of friendship than I have ever read about. And I hope that that's what I made.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's true. Let's talk about how much do you think your getting ill influenced your friendship? I mean, would you have gotten as close to Allison if you had not been dealing with a life-threatening illness yourself?
No, I don't think so. And before I got, and so I got really surprisingly and really suddenly sick. So, you know, I was fine. I was doing great. I was a little tired sometimes. And then I was a little confused and I was sure I was fine. And then all of a sudden I, you know, was in a neurosurgeon's office discussing brain surgery to, as he thought, confirm a malignant brain tumor. I mean, it was just like, everything was fine. I was having a regular life. I was 30. I was very interested in 30-year-old things. And then I thought I was going to die. And until I experienced that, I had no understanding of so much of the daily contour of Allison's life. So, you know, I would hear her and she would talk about having a CT scan. And I was like, you've had 100 CT scans. How are you still scared? Until I realized that, you know, my life started to feel parceled out into these increments of time between brain MRIs. And the understanding was always that the next MRI was probably going to show something really scary. And so I had to learn to parcel my life out. And as I was experiencing this, a lot of what she'd said to me started to make more sense. So she'd said these things like, you know, the experience of hope is worthwhile regardless of what happens. That didn't make any sense to me when I was 30 and just really, really worried about my grad school professors thinking that I was the smartest grad student, which I wasn't, you know, but that was my greatest wish for myself, was that people think that I was really smart. And then when I got sick, all these things that Allison had said started to make sense. It also, you know, it really softened me. I mean, I was, and I lean into this pretty hard in the beginning of the book. I was reading it to one of my best friends and she was like, oh, Eva, you're kind of a jerk. And I was like, yeah. I mean, I was so scared of intimacy and I was so scared of being vulnerable that I was kind of a jerk because I didn't know any other way to be. And when I was so sick, I was so desperate that I just had to tell people, you know, what was really going on. And I had seen Allison do that successfully. I had seen, as I said earlier, like, I'd seen her be honest and people be drawn to it. And so I sort of knew that was an option. That was a way to be. And when I was so sick that I was awake for 3 or 4 hours a day, I couldn't really read. I definitely couldn't write. I mean, I was very, very, very out of it. And people still wanted to come over and people still loved me. And their love influenced me, but it was really living with her for a couple of weeks after I had this hemorrhage in my brain that really started to change things. And, you know, in retrospect, I mean, I wouldn't trade any of it. Like, my friendship with her changed my life more than anything else. And I think that, you know, I've thought, well, did illness change my perspective? You know, was it getting sick? Was it almost dying? It wasn't. It was the way that I'd seen her do it and the way that I ultimately watched her die that really changed my life. And I had to get sick to be able to experience that and to be willing to be that vulnerable, you know, which was so my least favorite word. I used to not even be able to say it. I'd talk to my friend and I'd be like, you know, I feel it rhymes with vulnerable, you know, because I just like couldn't tolerate the idea of people seeing me clearly and accurately.
Wow. Wow.
You mentioned in your book about self-care. Did you have an idea what that was before you experienced all these things, or is it
none.
A new concept?
None. Yeah, I was talking to a friend yesterday about, I had my friend Jason, who has sort of a walk-on role in the last second and third acts. He talked a lot about self-care and I was just like, Jason, I don't understand what do you mean? What is self-care? And he was like, you know, I get a massage or I eat healthy. And I, at the same time, remember Cameron was really aware of her body, you know, so she would say things like, ooh, when I eat pork, I don't feel so great. Or my right side is a little tighter than my left. And I remember just being like, how do you know that? How do you know that pork doesn't agree with you? How do you know that your right side is tighter than your left? Like, I had no relationship with my body at all. And so the notion of caring for even my physical vessel was totally alien to me. And because that was impossible, caring for myself emotionally wasn't even on my radar. I didn't understand that I deserved care, that was something that I could give to myself, that was something I could ask for. I mean, I think self-care now is a very hot and trendy topic, you know, but 8 or 9 years ago when my friend Jason first was like, I'm going to do some self-care, I was like, where is that in the dictionary? I don't like, no, that's what I go to, you know, alcohol, drugs, random strangers and validation for, you know, that's where I get my self-care. That's how I feel good. And I've learned now that actually none of those are self-care for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eva, you say you hate being vulnerable, but this book, the honesty about your life and yourself, doesn't that make you feel vulnerable?
So this has been an ongoing conversation with my therapist who read the book, and she said, wow, it's really intimate. And I said, aha, I have tricked you. You think it is intimate because of the power of my art. And then a couple weeks later, I dragged myself into her office and I said, oh God, I tricked myself.
Oh.
It is vulnerable. I am the person who was tricked.
Right. So a part of me really wants to hide. And I keep making these jokes with people where I'm like, why didn't anybody remind me that this was going to be published? You know, because as I said before, when I was writing the book, I really was just in the world of the book. I was just like, what does the book need? I'll give it this. The book needs this. Great. I have this story. I have this material. I have this copy. But I talked to a friend of mine who's very wise. And I said, why did I do this? Why don't I have a job where I'm just behind the scenes and nobody knows me? And, you know, why? And she just said, Eva, this is just your job. Your job is to tell the truth about yourself, to try and help other people. And we don't know why that's your job, but that's what it is. And you're pretty good at it. So great. You know, it is scary to put something like this out there. And I actually haven't read it back to front to back in some time, because I feel like I need to sort of brace now that I know what's actually out there. But all of that fear and anxiety, it disappears the minute somebody sends me an email. And this happened recently. I sent it to somebody. I got an email an hour later and she said, you know, I have 5 other books that I really have to read, but for some reason, yours called to me. Mm-hmm. I have 70 days sober. Every single page is a punch. I feel seen. I've never felt so intimately known. I'm uncomfortable. And I also am so relieved that I'm not the only person who thinks like this. And I'm like, that's why I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
So that the person who has 70 days sober or no time sober, but who feels terrible about herself, can just see me be like, you know, I did that shit too. It's okay. People still loved me. I can still love myself. And when I'm reminded of that sort of deeper ambition, then I can withstand knowing that, you know, I'm going to have people critique me. I'm going to have men on the internet say that I made bad decisions. Okay. Thank you, men on the internet. And so when I'm oriented towards the ways in which the book can be helpful and useful, then I don't have fear.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now you also go into your upbringing, your family life, and there's some pain there and some, you're telling some truth telling that maybe some other members of your family might not be that thrilled about. How have you dealt with that?
So my mom really wanted to read the book, and I just thought, oh God, this is going to be pretty rough. But I sent it to her, and she's also, you know, she's a philosophy professor. So she reads a lot and she understands the difference between writing and a diary. You know, this is not my diary. And so she read it and she wrote me an email and she just said, wow,
I read this in one sitting. I couldn't put it down. This is amazing. She said it's, I think she said it reminded her of Didion or Sylvia Plath. She was like, this is going to be a classic. This is going to be taught in literature classes. You know, she was really into it as a work of art. And that was so meaningful to me because I was so afraid that, you know, she was going to complain about it. And it's so funny because the one complaint that she had was I describe our dinner table when I was a child, and I describe it as being very formal. And, you know, we have lit candles and everybody's really expected to perform. And there was not a sense of easy warmth or conviviality. And she was like, was it really like that? And I'm like, I talk about so many more objectively, like, appalling things. And it just shows you, right? I've always heard, like, the things people will critique in your book are never the things that you think that they're going to. So, but my grandmother read it and she sent me an email and just said, wow, I'd really love to discuss some things with you when you come visit next time. And I wrote back and said, oh no. And she said, no, nothing bad. But, you know, in a way, having the people who know me, who are in my family, read it is a lot more unnerving. My in-laws read it. That I was nervous about, you know, because my in-laws, they're pretty religious. They're, I mean, they're very progressive. They're socially liberal. But I just thought, like, do they want to know that their daughter-in-law was, like, sleeping with random dudes on press trips? Like, oh, you know, this is not. But they, I got the most amazing text from my mother-in-law. And she just said, I loved it. I love you. It makes your life make so much more sense to me. And she said that she felt like a weight had been lifted. Like she had been worried about, you know, because Winston and I mean, we got married and then I went to the desert and had this like possibly psychotic break, possibly physical illness. You know, we have a very independent marriage. We're very different from the other three couples in his family, his three brothers. And I think when she read the book and just saw how much I love him and how much he loves me and how much we've really consciously built the relationship that we have, she said that she just felt real relief. So I think I just have to keep trusting that. But you know, my father, he's going to read it, and I talk a lot about the pain that his absence caused me. And one reason that I'm grateful that it took me this long to sell a book, right? I'm not 30 under 30. I mean, I'm 36 now, is that I had worked through a lot of the stuff in therapy and I'd worked through a lot of it with my father. And so I'd had a conversation with him where I'd said, you know, your absence was really confusing to me when I was a child. And he had said, you know, the greatest regret of my life is that I didn't try harder. And so I got to say to him, you know, there are going to be parts in this book that might make you feel sad. And just remember that, like, in real life, our relationship is great. We have worked through this. And that's clear in the book, too. I mean, I describe how difficult it is. And then I also describe how we've come together. But I had to kind of give him the spoiler headline. You know, I was like, I had to describe that because otherwise people are going to be like, why is this person so weird with people? You know, why is she? I had to provide the evidence, you know, for why I was so afraid and why I was so lonely and why I felt so isolated. So I'm really lucky in that my family are pretty artistic and they are able to see, you know, the book needed these scenes to be in it. This is not a personal indictment. This is not a revenge piece. This is not me, like, you know, taking out my journal and being like, I'm mad at these people. And I really, really tried to always, you know, have any critique be about how I dealt with something, not about what the event was.
Well, right really at the beginning, you talk about, you know, that you were raised knowing that you'd be sent away, mm-hmm. and that your mother and your grandmother were the same, that mm-hmm. that was a tradition in the family, that that if you were smart enough, you got sent away to boarding school, to a fine, you know, boarding school. Yeah. Do you... And for you, maybe this was maybe not the ideal thing for you because you were, it maybe contributed to your loneliness. But do you see some benefit to it too?
I see huge benefit. I am extraordinarily adaptable. I can pretty much be fine wherever. I'm great with uncertainty. I'm A+ with chaos. The boarding school that I went to, I got a tremendous education. I think if I hadn't gone there, I wouldn't have gotten into Princeton. I also had parents who valued education. You know, when Princeton was like, hi, we're going to charge you, you know, X thousand dollars, they were willing to pay. You know, I had student loans and I had aid, but it was an important thing to them. And I saw a lot of my friends whose parents would basically bribe them to stay home and go to the local university instead of going to another one. And I was so glad that my parents were like, go, you know, be free, find your passion. So I think that I have a lot of really, really good adaptive, good coping mechanisms. And I think just having, valuing a life of thought and work and art and a life that is about ideas. I mean, I feel so grateful that that was so highly valued, because I always knew that being a writer was a reasonable job. And you know, my parents wanted me to have health insurance, but
we've been having such a fun time talking, Eva. I forgot to ask you to read, and we're almost to the end.
Okay.
So
okay.
What would you like to share with us today?
So I want to read a section from pretty early on. This is the scene where I've just met Allison and I'm in grad school and I'm having a whale of a time. So I'll just read a couple pages.
All right.
By the time I met Allison, I'd never felt truly close to someone. Not the way I'd seen other people be close to their friends. Had never shown all of myself, the most private and intimate and deepest selves, not to anyone. I had connections, friendships, some of which had lasted more than a decade, but there was always some distancing. I'd show one friend the side of me that was grieving over a relationship, another friend the side of me that believed, down to my core, that love was possible. But to show both sides to one person? Impossible. And so I compartmentalized, categorized. Found moments of truth in drugs and alcohol, but never in clarity, never in moments that lasted. I lied by omission. I swerved. That isn't how I wanted to be, but it was all that I knew. And when I met someone new, instead of listening or being open, I judged. I'd been taught that by the rubrics of my family, which focus on achievement, production, the presentation of perfect self in everyday life, to misquote the social theorist Irving Goffman. Later, of course, as I unwound over the course of 4 years of constant and life-threatening illness, I would understand why my behavior could have seemed sociopathic, as it was sometimes called, why I had created that distance. But before Allison loved me into becoming a different person, until, as I told her before she died, she midwifed the person I had wanted to be into existence, I couldn't get what all the fuss was about. And then finally, things started to change, not because of me, but because of her. An early evening in November, I was walking down College Avenue toward the Rockridge BART station. I had my headphones in because I always had my headphones in, because otherwise the chatter in my head, the noise that told me that I was assessing things incorrectly, that I shouldn't have said that thing to that professor, that my attempts at my life changes were totally failing, became deafening. But even above the music, I heard a, hey, Eva. And to my left, I saw a green Honda, a car I would later drive to the hospital to take her to the oncologist who would tell her that she was really dying this time. A make and model of car I would years later see sometimes on the streets of Berkeley and look for her and forget that she was dead. But for now, it was just Allison alive, with Sadie on a blanket in the front seat. Get in! I got in, putting Sadie on my lap, but not before putting on the social armature of dealing with an old and sick person. I prepared to be polite, respectful. I prepared myself for talking about general topics, books, grad school, perhaps some gossip. I prepared myself to have a social interaction that would just slip its way into my roster of social interactions that I needed to get through to get to the next thing. And instead, I looked at her and saw her face and her eyes and her tiny mouth from which so many words had poured and from which a few more came, and a tightness in my chest uncoiled, just a millimeter. Where are you headed? I wanted to lie, to dissemble the same way I dissembled the specifics of school, but instead, as I felt that tightness uncoil just another millimeter, I edged into addressing reality. A party in the city with this guy, it's his birthday. And then, truth. I'm worried I'm going to sleep with him. Is that likely? I told Allison how I'd met Matt 2 years earlier in the airport in line for a delayed flight headed from New York to Heathrow, where we'd started talking and then exchanged emails and decided to hang out in London, how we'd had a mini fling, which was relevant because I was in the middle of switching from one relationship to another, adding a third person to the mix because, of course you did, she interrupted. I continued on, saying I wanted to feel alive, she interrupted again. I've always seen him in cities neither of us lives in, and it's weird now that we live in the same place, I said. Now was the time for her to say something wise and also in line with my original thought. I waited for her to tell me to live my best life now and not give my precious gift away, or to tell me that having sex with someone I wasn't dating was bad behavior, was something I should stop doing. Everyone else in my life was advising me to change my ways. I was sober, and yet I had this predilection for going to bars and sipping club soda while everyone else got hammered and finding a Target and casually flirting and then bringing him home. And the last person I'd done this with had a girlfriend whom I'd met 10 minutes before I took him home. I have a hall pass, he told me, and I hadn't cared that he was probably lying because my wants were more important than the truth. The thing is, it doesn't matter. You're still you, she said. We are not saints. Sure, we weren't saints, but we were always trying to improve, right? I'd always thought everything we were doing was about becoming a better person and developing better habits. And here in this car in the rain, Allison had just offered me something different. And then it was 7:30 and I had to leave, had to make it to the group dinner at the hot new restaurant. And so I reached across the car to do what I'd always seen everyone do with Allison, touch her, hold her, squeeze her shoulder and her arm. I didn't do it because I wanted connection, but because it felt like the next right thing to do to maintain kindness, to acknowledge her. I'd seen people touch her like that in meetings and would learn later about the particular physical tourism of illness, the way in which we begin to sanctify those who are closer to death than we believe we are. Later, I would be touched in the way that she was, touristed in the way that she was. But that was later, after I got sick, after I joined her kingdom.
And that was Eva Hagberg Fisher reading from How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship. And my excuse for getting your name wrong before is I was in Vienna last year.
It's a great reason. You are forgiven.
All right. And we're out of time. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Your questions were so great. Thank you.
And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. You know, actually, our friends are the family we choose.
And that is very appropriate for this book, for sure. So thank you all, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.